Welcome to Roots of Faith, coming to you from the Synagogue Without Walls. Each week, Ross Nichols teaches from the historic Temple Sinai in St. Francisville, Louisiana, inspiring people to live a more biblically authentic lifestyle. And now, Ross Nichols.
Okay, shalom and welcome to Sunday Shul. Before I get started, we're getting a little bit more fancy as we go. We've got a little bit more technology going tonight than we usually do. So I just want to tell you, I'm not sure if you're listening or watching. If you're listening to me through the normal audio feed, we are trying a new video feed. So I'm going to tell you before I get started tonight how to get there. If you go to rootsoffaith.net, rootsoffaith.net, and look along the top of that website, you'll see a series of tabs. And one of those tabs says webcast. As you put your cursor over webcast, you'll see all of the links to all of our current media, whether that's podcast, live audio, live video. If you want to watch this, and this is a trial tonight, I think it's all working. We did a test earlier, and we had a woman named Deborah from Boston who actually got to see a little bit of that test. But if you go to rootsoffaith.net, go to webcast, and then select live audio, our hope is that you will see and hear tonight's class. Tonight's class, by the way, is called The Testimony. The Testimony, that's the title. Before we started the class tonight, I have to say this, though. We walked out on the porch of the synagogue, the group here, and we looked at a moon which is about 2 days old, I guess. It's just past the new moon, and there's a planetary alignment, so it's absolutely gorgeous. Wherever you're at, if it's nighttime where you are, I hope you take the time tonight and look at that. We're talking a lot more about that. People that are awakening to Torah faith understand that the festival of the new moon was an ancient festival that we've somewhat neglected up until recently, and I think people are beginning to understand that there's an importance in following the times and seasons. So it's very important that we look for the new moon, the crescent. Before I get into tonight's class about the testimony, which we're going to talk about the Ark of the Covenant, you know, the famed Ark, the one that is searched for, and one of the, if it were found, it would be the greatest of all archaeological discoveries. So we're going to talk about that. I may even give you a little clue as to at least one ancient opinion as to where it's at. So it might be pretty fun. You might want to take notes for that. But before I get started, I want to talk a little bit about something that we're doing that we're calling the Synagogue Without Walls, for those that may not have heard this or may not know about it. One of the things that I get a lot in emails from people literally all over the world is that they feel alone. And so one of the things that I feel called to do is to help meet that need. People that feel alone, you know, as they uncover these Hebraic roots and they start to understand the origins of their faith, they really don't fit in anymore with maybe the faith that they grew up with. And I point out a lot of times in these correspondences that I have, the first thing that God declares that's not good in Genesis chapter 2:18 is for man to be alone. In other words, that's the first thing God points out to us that's not good. So we really do want to create a world, an environment, where people don't have to feel alone. They can come in and meet friends and so forth. In fact, today, as I was making my final notes for tonight's class, I thought about a passage. I grew up in a church, and like many of you did, and there's a passage in the writing of Hebrews, Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24 and 25. And that passage says, let me open up to it, make sure I don't misquote it. People will write me if I do. It's Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24. It applies to what I'm talking about here, so let me get to it. Okay. It says, "And let us consider how to provoke one another to love and good deeds, not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. You know, when you think about that, provoke one another to love and good deeds and encourage one another, I really think that that's an interesting way to look at what we ought to be doing. In fact, the thing that made me think about this is that translations vary on that passage. The King James translates, if I remember right, not neglecting the assembling of ourselves together or something of that nature, or not forsaking. Forsake not the assembling of ourselves together is the way King James translates. Anyway, in both cases, the Greek word behind this phrase, either meeting together or assembling together, is a Greek word. The Greek word is the same word from which we get the word synagogue. And a synagogue, of course, is a place of assembly. So what we're trying to do is create a synagogue without walls. That's what we've come to call this group that we are now forming with people from all over. Next week, by the way, this is my announcement time. I get wound up this way. Next week, by the way, on Sunday, December the 7th, Roots of Faith will celebrate its third anniversary. The local congregation here at the Temple Sinai Synagogue in St. Francisville, Louisiana, not only do we want you to be part of this celebration, we really want you to be part of the congregation. So I'm going to do a teaching next Sunday night at Sunday Shul, as usual. However, I want to bring in a different element, and that element is to talk about the things that we have been blessed with here as a group. And that involves not only the local group, but those that listen in. So I'll send out more details on that at a later date. Not too much later. Sometime between now and next weekend. The site that we've set up for a synagogue without walls is rootsoffaith.net. It's a lot like MySpace or Facebook. You know, it's one of those kind of sites where you can actually log in and set up your own page. And you have people from all over that you get to know, and you kind of, it creates almost a cyber community, which is really what I wanted to do. And you can load up your own pictures so people get to know each other, and you can chat. There's a forum, just all kind of things. A lot of the features I'm not sure we really know how to use yet, but nonetheless, it's a very good thing. I encourage you to go to rootsoffaith.net and find some friends. You know, we don't want you to be alone, so. Okay, now that that's out of the way, tonight's class is the sixth class in a series that I'm teaching based upon my own teacher's book, James Tabor's Restoring Abrahamic Faith. This is the sixth class. All the others are on my website, rootsoffaith.org. But this is the third class on a subject that's called Following the Way of God. Following the way of God. Last week, I taught specifically on the Torah and how that applies to following the way of God. And it's based off of, so this is really, I guess you would say, tonight's class is part two. Part one was on the Torah. Tonight's class is on the testimony. And both of those come from a passage in Isaiah chapter 8. So I want you to go to Isaiah chapter 8. And we're going to begin in verse 16. Isaiah chapter 8, beginning in verse 16. This is from a passage in a class that James taught one time called To the Torah and the Testimony. So, chapter 8, verse 16 of Isaiah, it says, "Bind up the testimony, seal the Torah," it says teaching in most translations, "among my disciples. I will wait for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob, and I will hope in him. See, I and the children whom the Lord has given me are for signs and portents in Israel, from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh of host, who dwells on Mount Zion. Now if people say to you, consult the ghost and the familiar spirits that chirp and mutter, should not a people consult their God, the dead on behalf of the living? To the Torah and to the testimony. Surely those who do not speak according to this word have no light in them. The translation that I have varies from that quite drastically. They will pass through the land greatly distressed and hungry. When they are hungry, they will be enraged and will curse their king and their God. They will turn their faces upward, or they will look to the earth, but they will only see distress and darkness, gloom of anguish, and they will be thrust into thick darkness. Now, as Tabor points out in his book on this particular passage, the setting of this passage is immediately prior to the appearance of the Davidic Messiah. So, think about this. I'm going to kind of set the context for you. But it's sometime between the exile and the final redemption. So it's before, immediately prior to the appearance of the Messiah, but it's between the exile and the redemption. The situation described in this particular passage in Isaiah chapter 8 is really a dark, dark situation. There's darkness, there's gloom, great distress, anger, famine. I mean, when you read this, you really get this feeling that it's just almost like an oppressive cloud that's over this time, right before things break open, right? People are cursing God, you know, and their king. The masses, really, in this particular passage, are seen as groping about. First, they're described as walking, and then they're driven deeper into darkness. So where are they going for answers? It says, really, that they're seeking their answers from mediums and from wizards. I think this translation says ghost and familiar spirits that chirp and mutter. Really, what it reminds me of is almost like this, it's a description of some type of New Age religion grounded in the occult. You know, it's really a dark, dark, oppressive type deal. One thing that jumps out at me when I read this particular passage, it's from a study that I did quite some time back, is the fact that people are hungry. Now, I'm not trying to over-spiritualize this. In other words, I believe that there will be physical famines. You know, like people are like hungry physically. They need some food to eat. But one of the points that I want to make out is the Bible speaks of a famine that in some ways, in my opinion, is even more severe and threatening than would be a lack of mere food. So if you would, go to Amos chapter 11. Amos 11. I want to read of this particular famine. Amos 11, it says, I'm going to read verse 11 and 12. The time is surely coming, says the Lord God, when I will send a famine on the land. Chapter 8, verse 11. Amos 8, verse 11 and 12. Time is surely coming, says... I was seeing if you were listening. Says the Lord God, when I will send a famine on the land, not a famine of bread or of thirst for water, but of hearing the words of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. They shall wander from sea to sea and from north to east. They shall run to and fro seeking the word of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, but they shall not find it. Now, I would go as far as to say that we're in a famine of that sort now. I really believe that people are starving to death for the Word of God, and they're looking for it. You know, when I think about this, and I think about this hunger that's coming, you think of passages like Ezekiel chapter 34. One of the things that God is really upset with the shepherds in Ezekiel 34 is that they fed themselves, but they haven't fed the sheep. This is a description of a famine where people are searching for food. But it's not food like you think of bread and water. It's of hearing the Word of God. When Ezekiel 34, God says He's going to feed His own sheep. And I see that happening. What I'm seeing, people are writing into the website and they're saying, you know, I have people that when they write in, what they say is, I was all alone. I started reading my Bible. And as I read my Bible, I began to understand and I saw things. They were saying things that were different than what I was taught. So that's where we're at. God's actually feeding the people now. It's a little bit different because He couldn't trust the shepherds to do it, right? Read Ezekiel 34. Even in the darkest times, called here in Isaiah chapter 8, the hiding of the face, if you will. It's referred to throughout the Bible as the hiding of the face. When the times are the darkest, God does feed His people. He makes a provision. You know, I think about stories in the Hebrew Bible where Elijah's fed by a raven. You know, I mean, there are things that God does to ensure that His people are fed physically and spiritually. In this case, we're talking about a spiritual feeding. In Isaiah chapter 8, we read of two groups. The first group that we're talking about are those who have departed from the way. They're described in Isaiah chapter 8. They're the ones who are groping about in darkness. They're seeking wizards and they're going to spiritism and occult. They're listening to ghosts and familiar spirits which chirp and which mutter. That group is also described in Isaiah chapter 30. If you would, go to Isaiah chapter 30. Isaiah chapter 30, verse 8, it says, "Go now, write it before them on a tablet and inscribe it in a book, so that it may be for the time to come as a witness forever. For they are rebellious people, faithless children, children who will not hear the instruction of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, who say to the seers, 'Do not see,' and to the prophets, 'Do not prophesy to us what is right. Speak to us smooth things, prophesy illusions. Leave the way, turn aside from the path. Let us hear no more about the Holy One of Israel.'" Now that's a pretty sad state. But this particular group, the group that I would say is a group who has departed and or is departing from the way, they're looking in the wrong direction for help. They're going to these wizards and so forth. So that's the one group. Now God's people have been warned about the very things that we see in Isaiah chapter 8. It's in the Torah. If you look at Deuteronomy chapter 18, you know, really one of the things that I think people are looking for, they're searching for answers. And if what they find in the place that they grew up, in their particular denomination or their particular faith, if they don't get answers, they just start looking. Well, this particular passage in Isaiah chapter 8 tells us that they're looking in the wrong places. And what I want to show you here in Deuteronomy 18 is that they were warned against where they're looking. So look at verse 9, Deuteronomy 18, verse 9. "When you come into the land that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh your God is giving you, you must not learn to imitate the abhorrent practices of those nations. No one shall be found among you who makes a son or daughter pass through the fire, or who practices divination, or is a soothsayer, or an augur, or a sorcerer, or one who casts spells, or who consults ghosts or spirits, or who seeks oracles from the dead. For whoever does these things is abhorrent to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. It is because of such abhorrent practices that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh your God is driving them out before you." Remember in Isaiah 8, it's talking about all the same stuff. They're being driven out. "You must remain completely loyal to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh your God. Although these nations that you are about to dispossess do give heed to soothsayers and diviners, as for you, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh your God does not permit you to do so." It says these are abhorrent practices. Now, the Gentile nations that practice these, actually, what happens to them? They're dispossessed. In fact, in places, the word is almost the same as, like, threw them out, vomited out of the land. They're cast forth from the land for practicing these particular passages. Notice also that this particular passage does not say that these practices don't work. Interesting point, right? What it says, rather, is that God has not permitted His people to practice them. Because remember, the Bible has stories about, think about Saul and the witch of Endor. Remember, he practices, he calls Saul forth from the dead, basically. He goes to consult the dead on behalf of the living. It's the very thing that we're talking about here. But that's what we're told, is that God has not permitted His people to do that. So, He doesn't say it doesn't work. He just says they can't. So what is it that the people of Israel who are following God's way, what are they supposed to do? How is it that they're supposed to receive revelation from God? Look, it's in this very passage. Look at verse 15 of Deuteronomy 18. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own people. You shall heed such a prophet. This is what you requested of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, at Horeb on the day of the assembly when you said, if I hear the voice of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, my God, anymore, or ever see this great fire, I'll die. Then Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh replied to me, they are right in what they've said. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their own people. I'll put my words in the mouth of the prophet, or in the mouth of the prophets, who shall speak to them everything that I command. Anyone who does not heed the words that the prophet shall speak in my name, I myself will hold accountable. But any prophet who speaks in the name of other gods, or who presumes to speak in my name a word that I've not commanded the prophet to speak, that prophet shall die. You may say to yourself, how can we recognize a word that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh has not spoken? And verse 22 says, if a prophet speaks in the name of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, but the thing does not take place or prove true, it's a word that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. Do not be frightened by it. All right. So, where is one to go in order to hear from God? Isaiah chapter 8 tells us very specifically, the phrase is, to the Torah and to the testimony. Now, what we have in Deuteronomy 18 lines up with that. Because what we're talking about in Deuteronomy 18 is that God would put His words in the mouth of the prophet, and that they would speak what it was that He needed them to speak. We're even warned here in Isaiah chapter 8, where I started, that if they, whomever, if they do not speak according to the Torah and the testimony, what does it mean? It's because there's no light in them. To the Torah and to the testimony, if they speak not according to this word, it's because there's no light in them. It doesn't say they don't have a lot of light. It says there's no light. Now, last week we did talk about the Torah. And we talked about what the Torah is. But this week's class begs the question, and I'm going to kind of string it along just a minute. What is the testimony? What is the testimony? Now, in Isaiah chapter 8, look at Isaiah chapter 8 again, just to kind of set the stage. Isaiah 8 obviously leads into 9, and if you look at the way chapter 9 begins, it says, there will be no gloom for those who were in anguish. In the former times, He brought them into contempt, the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, He will make glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Something happens. Now remember, you have to think of this. Don't take it out of context. If you take these passages in a continuous flow, we just talked in Isaiah chapter 8 about this darkness and gloom. And it mentions the word light, right? That there's light, but light is associated with the Torah and the testimony. So what actually dawns here? That's kind of what we're going to talk about as we get into it. But it does stand to reason that the content or the context of chapter 8 and chapter 9 have to be understood together. Now when we talk about what is the testimony, we have to go to the Torah. Remember the Torah of Moses, Malachi says at the end. Look at Exodus. Let's go to Exodus chapter 25. Because if we're searching for light in a world of darkness, and I don't mean that to sound like I'm a dualist, like, you know, I'm thinking that the world is an evil, dark place. But there is this darkness, this veil almost, over the people. The prophets talk about it. And in order to break through that veil, we have to have light penetrate. And it talks about the Torah and the testimony bringing that light. So what is the testimony? Look at Exodus chapter 25, beginning in verse 10. Now remember, I told you we were going to talk tonight about the Ark of the Covenant. Listen to this. They shall make an ark of acacia wood. It shall be 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, and 1.5 cubits high. You shall overlay it with pure gold. Inside and outside you shall overlay it. And you shall make a molding of gold upon it all around. You shall cast 4 rings of gold for it and put them on its 4 feet. 2 rings on one side, 2 rings on the other side. You shall make poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. You shall put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark by which to carry the ark. Does that sound like a beautiful object? Absolutely. The poles shall remain in the rings of the ark. They shall not be taken from it. You shall put into the ark the covenant that I shall give you. Now, it also could be translated testimony. Alright? Shall put the testimony that I shall give you. So, whatever this ark is, in fact, the word ark, sometimes translated chest, really means a box. So here's this box. It's beautiful. It's overlaid with gold. There are rings of gold, poles through it, acacia wood covered in gold. Absolutely beautiful. And we're not even through describing it. And inside of it, by the way, almost like a side note, you shall put the testimony. So the box, you're going to put the testimony in the box. In Hebrew, the word translated, whether it's translated covenant or testimony or whatever other words are used in translation, is the Hebrew word edut. Edut. And this word is from a root word, ed, which means witness. A witness. So this object that goes in, it's what we're going to talk about tonight. But I'm not through talking about how beautiful the box is yet. So hold on just a second. Verse 17. Now, the other thing is that we have a lot of theological language. A lot of theological language. If you look at the original, it might not be quite as theological. You know, some of you have heard me talk about the word atonement and how it literally means a cover, you know, a covering. Well, this is the same. We have a lot of theological words. Then you shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. A cover is what that word is. 2.5 cubits shall be its length, 1.5 cubits its width. And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold. You shall make them of hammered work at the ends of the cover. So there's a cover on top. And it's going to have these 2 cherubim, these 2 beams that are facing one another. Make 1 cherub at the one end and 1 cherub at the other of 1 piece with the lid. And you shall make the cherubim at its 2 ends. The cherubim shall spread out their wings above, overshadowing the cover with their wings. So they're facing one another. Their wings are outstretched. You've seen it depicted various ways. You know, there's some debate as to exactly what it looked like. But these wings would reach out over the cover and touch one another, right? Verse 20, the cherubim shall spread out their wings above, overshadowing the cover. They shall face one another. The faces of the cherubim shall be turned toward the mercy seat, or the top, the lid. So they're looking down. You know, it's like they're looking down, we can assume. You shall put the top, the lid, the mercy seat, on top of the ark. And in the ark, the box, you shall put the covenant, or the testimony, that I shall give you. Now, this is a key point. It is there I will meet with you, and from above the mercy seat, above the lid, from between the 2 cherubim that are on the ark of the testimony, I will deliver to you all my commands for the Israelites. Now, a lot of people will read this and they'll think about the beauty of the box. And they'll think about the beauty of the lid and the wonder of the work into the cherubim whose wings spread across the lid. And by the way, inside this box is my testimony. Inside the box is a testimony. You know, a lot of people think outside the box. Tonight, I really want you to think inside the box. What's inside the box? That's the question. I'm going to go through several passages tonight. When we talk about the Ark of the Covenant, or the Ark of the Testimony, you know, most people do focus on the outside. Whether it's the quest, you know, I got an email this week that a certain scholar, a certain archaeologist, is making another attempt to find the Ark of the Covenant. Now, I'm going to tell you, this would absolutely be the most incredible. Can you imagine? Can you imagine the news media and what they would do? I mean, people would be glued to it from all over. We found the Ark of the Covenant. The Hollywood movie Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's one of my favorite movies. But I mean, people, if you think about it, that would absolutely shake the world. It'd be specials on. There's specials on television now. You know, there's a story. I read a book. I've gotten into this too. I read book. A book by Graham Hancock, you know, on the search for the Ark. I've probably read most of the books I can find on this. I've seen the specials on television shows and documentaries. The story, one version of the story says that the Ark traveled with one of Solomon's sons from a union with the Queen of Sheba. She had a son, and this particular son was sent to Jerusalem to study with Solomon, you know, in the courts of Solomon. And then they took that particular, he took the secrets of the things that he learned from the priest, and he went back to Ethiopia. This is one version. I'm not saying, so don't like everybody fly to Ethiopia to look for it. But there, this is a strong version of the story. And he took with him the real Ark of the Covenant, and it's there kept in like this tabernacle where this particular group of people practiced the religion of ancient Israel. That's one story. Here's another story. I have it in my Bible, 2 Maccabees. This is one version of where the Ark went. I think this is fascinating. It's in 2 Maccabees, if you have that. Of course, now you can pretty much look all this up on the web if you don't have that. I have a handy Bible that has the Hebrew Bible, the Apocrypha, as it's called, and the Christian Scriptures. It's the one that I used to study out of. Now, beginning in verse 1, I'm going to start in chapter 2, verse 1 of 2 Maccabees, chapter 2. It says, one finds in the records that the prophet Jeremiah ordered those who were being deported to take some of the fire, as has been mentioned, and that the prophet, after giving them the Torah, instructed those who were being deported not to forget the commandments of the Lord or to be led astray in their thoughts on seeing the gold and silver statues and their adornment. And with other similar words, he exhorted them that the law should not depart from their hearts. I like that. The Torah. Don't let the Torah depart from your hearts. He's telling them, you're fixing to go into Babylon, and we want you to keep the faith while you're there. All right, notice the next passage. It says, it was also in the same document that the prophet, having received an oracle, ordered that the tent and the ark should follow with him, and they went out to the mountain where Moses had gone up and had seen the inheritance of God. Jeremiah came and found a cave dwelling, and he brought there the tent, the tabernacle that is, and the ark and the altar of incense, and then he sealed up the entrance. All right, isn't that interesting? So some of those who followed him came up intending to mark the way, but they could not find it. When Jeremiah heard it or learned of it, he rebuked them and declared, "The place shall remain unknown until God gathers his people together again and shows his mercy. Then the Lord will disclose these things, and the glory of the Lord and the cloud will appear as they were shown in the case of Moses, and as Solomon asked that the place should be specially consecrated." Now, that's an interesting passage. It says that Jeremiah took the ark, the box, and he brought it with them when they went. And he goes to the mountain, and he finds this place, and he puts it in this cave dwelling and seals it up. And nobody knows where it is, right? Interesting story. But it mentions Jeremiah. So while we're talking about Jeremiah and talking about the ark, I have something else to read. Look at Jeremiah chapter 3. Jeremiah chapter 3. Now, a lot of people talk about the Ark of the Covenant, right? Very interesting subject for Bible lovers and studiers of these mysteries. Notice that in the passage I read in Maccabees, it says that this ark is going to remain hidden until God brings His people back together and so forth. Well, Jeremiah chapter 3 talks about this restoration or bringing God's people back together. And in verse 14, it says, "Return, O faithless children, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, for I am your master. I will take you, one from a city, two from a family, and will bring you to Zion." He says in verse 15, "I will give you shepherds after my own heart, who will feed you with knowledge and understanding. And when you've multiplied and increased in the land in those days," says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, get this, "they shall no longer say, the ark of the covenant of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. It shall not come to mind, or be remembered, or missed, nor shall another one be made. At that time, Jerusalem shall be called the throne of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and all nations shall gather to it, to the presence of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh in Jerusalem, and they shall no longer stubbornly follow their own evil way. In those days, the house of Judah shall join the house of Israel, and together they shall come from the land of the north to the land that I gave your ancestors for a heritage. It shall not come to mind. It won't be remembered. It won't be missed. Nor will another one be made." But wait a minute. You're telling me, I mean, think about it. Judah and Israel are back together. It's the goal. It's the most talked about theme in the prophets is the restoration of Israel. He's going to bring them back to their land, and the central object of worship is missing. Tragedy of tragedies. And you're not even going to think about it. You're not going to ask for it. Nobody's going to want it. Well, what are you going to do with the testimony? I mean, that's my question tonight. Because really, the box is designed to put the testimony in. So if you don't have the box, well, I know a lot of people would say, well, you don't need that anyway, but I'm going to show you tonight that you do. So the question would be, if the very purpose of the ark was to hold the testimony, and we're not going to need the ark anymore, we're not going to ask for it, what do you do with the testimony? In fact, just to make the point clear tonight, I'm going to go through several passages with you. We read from Exodus 25. Take note that the Ark of the Covenant, and it's popularly known as, is also called it's the Ark of the Testimony. Look at Exodus chapter 40. I'm going to read through several passages to make this particular point. Exodus chapter 40, let's go to verse 20. In verse 20 it says, "He took the edut, the testimony, and put it into the ark, put the poles on the ark, set the seat above the ark, and he brought the ark into the tabernacle and set up the curtains for screening and screened the ark of the testimony as Yod-Heh-Vav had commanded Moses. All right, so I want you to kind of visualize this. In past, we didn't have video then. I don't even know if we had audio. But we set the tabernacle here, or we set up in the temple an outline of what it looked like. And we made, I actually took a box and set it in the place, you know, I marked it off, how big it was and all that, just so people would see where it was located, and it kind of gave you a visual. So I want you to think about this. You know, here he's talking about how he's going to set this up. He takes the Eduk, puts it in the ark, puts the poles in there, and brings it in the tabernacle and sets it up, right? It's elsewhere. It's called the ark for the testimony. In other words, the very reason it was made is to contain this particular testimony. Now, the other thing, when I studied this, another key point. You know, let me see how to put this. The thing that the Torah talks more about than any other thing is the tabernacle and its contents. If you look at it from just content, the tabernacle and its contents, whether you know the objects associated with the tabernacle, there's more about that in the Torah than there is any other single subject. You remember the tabernacle, it's made according to the pattern that God shows Moses in the mount. And it's called the tabernacle of the testimony. All right, so I want you to understand the pattern, the way this is going. Look at Exodus 38. Exodus chapter 38. And verse 21, I believe. Exodus 38. It says, "These are the records of the tabernacle of the testimony, which were drawn up to the commandment up at the commandment of Moses, the work of the Levites being under the direction of Ithamar, son of the priest Aaron." The tabernacle of the testimony. In at least one place, the temple, which was later built, was called the house for the tabernacle. Okay, so if you think about it, what we're doing is, no matter how many objects or how many articles you build around, what we're really talking about is what's at the heart of it. So, the focal point, no matter what the progression, we have the box, you have a lid on the box, inside the box you have the testimony. Now, outside of the box, you have the tabernacle. And it's called the tabernacle of the testimony. So it's like every one of these things really are made to be around the testimony. And remember what this is for. It's the place where God would meet with His people. At this point, the testimony is always the focal point. So whatever is in the ark is a testimony. So now look at Deuteronomy chapter 10. Deuteronomy 10, beginning in verse 1. "At that time, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh said to me, 'Carve out two tablets of stone like the former ones, and come up to me on the mountain, and make an ark of wood, a box of wood.'" Verse 2, I will write on the tablets the words that were on the former tablets, which you smashed, and you shall put them in the ark. So I made a box of acacia wood, cut two tablets of stone like the former ones, and went up to the mountain with the two tablets in my hand." Notice, two tablets in his hand. How big were the tablets? Singular, in my hand. Might not be quite as big as what you see Charlton Heston carrying. In fact, in that movie, I don't remember, doesn't it show like it's cut, God's cutting it out with lightning or whatever? Anyway, I don't remember exactly. I might have to watch it again. Verse 4, it says, "Then he wrote on the tablets the same words as before, the Ten Commandments," as it's translated here. In Hebrew, it literally says, "the ten words." And we'll talk about that in a minute. "The ten words that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh had spoken to you on the mountain out of the fire on the day of the assembly, and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh gave them to me. So I turned and came down from the mountain and put the tablets in the box that I had made And there they are, as Yod-Heh-Vav commanded me. Exodus chapter 31. I want you to have all these passages because you will, in a sense, have all of them when we're finished. There's only a few more that I'm going to go through, but these are very key in studying this particular subject. Exodus 31, verse 18, it says, When God finished speaking with Moses on Mount Sinai, He gave him the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone written with the finger of God. I talked about this a little bit last week. Think about that. Yes, it'd be nice to find the box. It would shake the world. But I would think that even more astounding, more shocking, more amazing, more wonderful and marvelous, can you imagine seeing the 10 words written with the finger of God that are inside the box? Look at Exodus chapter 32, verse 15. Then Moses turned and went down from the mountain carrying the two tablets of the testimony in his hand. Tablets that were written on both sides, written on the front and on the back. Tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God, engraved upon the tablets. Now that's pretty powerful. Both sides, writing. You know, I don't know if it actually went through like to both sides, or if it was on both sides it was written the same words. Let's go back to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy, this time go to chapter 9. Deuteronomy 9. To the Torah and the testimony. Deuteronomy 9, beginning in verse 10. And Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh gave me the two stone tablets written with the finger of God. On them were all the words that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh had spoken to you at the mountain out of the fire on the day of the assembly. At the end of 40 days and 40 nights, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh gave me the two stone tablets, the tablets of the testimony. Now he references this several times. It's the central part of the ancient Hebrew worship system. It's the thing. It's the covenant. It is the testimony, the witness of the Creator of heaven and earth. The God that created heaven and earth one time wrote down His testimony on two stone tablets. And they were put inside the box. It's a beautiful box too. I know I'm jumping you around a little bit. Go back to Exodus. This is like Bible quiz. I just want to see if you can flip back and forth. Exodus chapter 24. Exodus 24 verse 12. And Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and wait there. And I will give you the tablets of stone with the law and the commandments which I have written for their instruction." Now, a key point here is that this particular passage here says that God wrote these for their instruction. Now, that tells me that they're supposed to teach us something. What were these 10 words, right? Exodus 34. A couple more passages. Exodus chapter 34, beginning in verse 27. And Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh said unto Moses, "Write these words, in accordance with these words I've made a covenant with you and with Israel." He was there with the Lord 40 days, 40 nights. He neither ate bread nor drank water. And he wrote on the tablets the words of the testimony, the 10 commandments. Or words. The 10 words. Literally in Hebrew, Devarim. The 10 words. In fact, again, in verse 29, it talks about him carrying on both hands.
or in one hand. Moses came down from Mount Sinai. As he came down from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, Moses didn't know that the skin of his face shone because he had been talking with God. Remember that story, right? Comes down, he's glowing. In his hand. These are the words of the covenant between God and His people. It's contained in two places, and although it's 20-some-odd verses, I want to read you this tonight. Because when we talk about following the way of God, and we read in Isaiah 8, to the Torah and to the testimony, if they don't speak according to this word, it's because there's no light in them. So if I think, and I do think, that there are many people who are not teaching according to this word, then I want to show you what is this word, the Torah and the testimony. I want to read the testimony to you tonight. This was delivered in Deuteronomy. We're going to read in Deuteronomy chapter 5, is where Moses recounts the story. But you ought to study on your own Exodus chapter 19 and 20, which talk about leading up to God delivering, you know, announcing His covenant with the people of Israel. There was thunder and there was lightning. The sound of a shofar so loud, it grew increasingly louder and louder. Remember? It's a very incredible story. It's the time when the Creator of the universe stepped onto the scene in our world, raised His hand and says, "This is My testimony." So Deuteronomy chapter 5. Beginning in verse 1. Moses convened all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and ordinances that I'm addressing to you today. You shall learn them and observe them diligently. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, our God, made a covenant with us at Horeb. Not with our ancestors did Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh spoke with you face to face at the mountain, out of the fire." In fact, there's a passage which calls this a fire law, Eshdat. At that time, verse 5, "I was standing between Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and you to declare to you the word of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, for you were afraid because of the fire and did not go up the mountain." And he said, "I'm Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above or that is on the earth beneath, or that is in the heaven, in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, am a jealous God, punishing children for the iniquity of parents to the third and fourth generation of those who reject me, but showing chesed, steadfast love, to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not make wrongful use of the name of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh will not acquit anyone who misuses his name. Observe the Sabbath day and keep it holy, as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh is a Sabbath to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God. You shall not do any work, you, your son, your daughter, your male or female slave, your ox, your donkey, or any of your livestock, or the resident alien in your town, so that your male and female slave may rest as well as you. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. Honor your father and your mother, as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, commanded you, so that your days may be long and that it may go well with you in the land that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, is giving you. You shall not murder, neither shall you commit adultery, neither shall you steal, neither shall you bear false witness against your neighbor, neither shall you covet your neighbor's wife, neither shall you desire your neighbor's house or field or male or female slave or ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. These words Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh spoke with a loud voice to your whole assembly at the mountain, out of fire, the cloud, the thick darkness, and he added no more. He wrote them on two stone tablets and gave them to me." So what was on the two tablets, what I just read. Nothing else. No commentary. That's it. And that was the testimony that God gave to His people. Key point. He added no more. It's called the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. It's the way we've come to know it. You know, I wanted to read a passage. James actually quotes this from in his book. Rabbi Hertz, the great rabbi of England, had this in his commentary. Many of the people here, I think all the people here, have Hertz's commentary on the five books of Moses. And this is what he says. The Decalogue, the ten words basically is what he's talking about, is a sublime summary of human duties binding upon all mankind. A summary unequaled for simplicity, comprehensiveness, and solemnity. A summary which bears divinity on its face and cannot be antiquated as long as the world endures. You know who else said that? Yeshua. It is at the same time a divine epitome of the fundamentals of Israel's creed and life, and Jewish teachers, ancient and modern, have looked upon it as a fountainhead from which all Jewish truth and Jewish teaching could be derived. You know, I began this lesson talking about doom, gloom, and darkness, a time when the masses turned to spiritism, occult, for answers. But the true disciples of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh are described in that particular passage as well. The true disciples. It starts off, bind the testimony, seal the Torah among my disciples. There's a warning to us that those who do not speak according to this word, it's because there's no light in them. Remember this point. No light. If they don't speak according to this word, there is no light in them. Now, I have, for quite some time, been teaching on the Hebraic origins and being very patient, and I think I should be, because, you know, part of what I'm trying to do is reach to people that may have never heard this. But as far as the teachers go, this is a very strong warning that teachers who are teaching, proclaiming to teach the way, people that are listening to me now need to understand that if they're not talking about the Torah and the testimony, they don't have any light in them. That's our job to provide that light. We should tell them, we should show them, but that we ought to at least pay attention to this warning, right? The testimony is the summation of the revelation of God's way. You know, if you think about all the other commandments, over the next week, I think I'm going to talk more about specifically about the commandments. You know, we talk about the Torah. We talk about the testimony, which is a summation of all of the commandments. Maybe next week we'll get into the commandments themselves. But these ten really can be broken down into almost like headings of categories you can think about. Like if you say, you shall not steal, what does that really mean? You can start thinking about what does it really mean to steal? But there's a lot more to it than just... But these ten, it's the summary, if you will. It's the headings. We learn that the whole reason for the ark was to contain the testimony. The box was built basically to contain the testimony of God. The tabernacle was erected so that God could meet with the people at the testimony, basically. You know, at the mercy seat, at the lid that covered the box. Because it's right there at His covenant where He's going to meet. But we also learned that this beautiful box is something that at some point in the future, according to Jeremiah chapter 3, when God raises up shepherds, the people are restored, Judah and Israel are restored, no longer will they be talking about the Ark of the Testimony. It's not going to be remembered, it's not going to be missed, and it's not going to be made again. So my question was, if God's eternal covenant, if His testimony, His eduk, is written upon these tablets, and there's nothing to put them in, what do we do? I think some of you might know where I'm going. Look at Jeremiah chapter 31. Now notice that this happens once the people are brought back together. Jeremiah 31, beginning in verse 31. Days are surely coming, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Not like the covenant that I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, a covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. But this is the covenant that I will make with them, with the house of Israel after those days, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. I will put my Torah within them. I will write it on their hearts. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people. No longer shall they teach one another or say to each other, Know Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, for I will forgive their iniquity and remember their sin no more. Now you think about Jeremiah for a minute. Talking to the people in his day, can you imagine? Everybody's talking about the temple and the tabernacle, or the temple and the Ark of the Covenant. And you know what he says? There's another passage in Jeremiah where he says, You that say, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. You know, almost like that's not the important thing. So here he's talking about a new covenant. There's a new covenant where God's going to literally write His instructions on your heart. You're not going to ask for the Ark of the Covenant anymore. You're not going to ask for a temple. Can you imagine what a revolutionary preacher this was in his day? In Jeremiah chapter 8, he says that this is even stronger. You know, he talks about in chapter 7 the sacrifices. Says that God never commanded the sacrifices when He brought them out of the land of Egypt, but He commanded them to obey His voice. In chapter 8, He says in verse 8, Who are we to say that we are wise and the Torah of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is with us? The lying pen of the scribes has made it a lie. I mean, this prophet, he was really preaching what it was that God was giving him. The Torah, think about it, the testimony written on the heart. I really do think that there's a famine in the land. And I really do believe that, you know, some of you know my understanding of the prodigal son. I think that we, like the prodigal son, have got to come to ourselves. I think people that quite possibly are listening to this class have to think about this. I'm waiting for the day and hope to help bring that in where non-Jews, the non-Jewish portion of God's people, let's say, awaken. And I hope that part of that realization is that they have been feeding pigs, basically. They're in a pigsty. What I want them to do is to come to themselves and return to God. Bring words, as Hosea the prophet says, and go to God, seeking His face, basically, and turning to His way. And I think we're actually seeing that. You think about when it says that they'll come to themselves. Read Deuteronomy chapter 30. Very powerful passage. And what does this lead to? It's a matter of the heart. It's a circumcision of the heart. Now, I started, one of the passages that I used about the Ark of the Covenant, the box of the testimony, was in Deuteronomy chapter 10. Now this is talking about the thing, the box, that holds God's testimony. You know what else it talks about in Deuteronomy chapter 10? Look at verse 12. So now, O Israel, what does Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, require of you? Only, now this is the same chapter that deals with the building of the ark. Only to fear Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, to walk in all His ways, to love Him, to serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, and His decrees that I'm commanding you today, for your own good. Although heaven and the heaven of heavens belong to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, the earth with all that's in it, yet Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh set His heart in love on your ancestors alone, and chose you, their descendants after them, out of all the people as it is today. Circumcise then the foreskin of your heart, and do not be stubborn any longer. For Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who is not partial and takes no bribe, who executes justice for the orphan and the widow, who loves the strangers, providing them food and clothing. You shall also love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall fear Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God. Him alone you shall worship. To Him you shall hold fast, and by His name you shall swear. He is your praise. He is your God, who has done for you these great and awesome things that your own eyes have seen. Your ancestors went down to Egypt, 70 persons, and now Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, has made you as numerous as the stars in heaven. When we strip away all the external objects of worship, we take away all the things that we've built around in our approach to God, what we're really left with is the idea of the heart. You know, when I think about it, God really is trying to put His Torah into the hearts of His people these days. That's the goal. It's always been the goal. It was the goal when the Torah was written. The intent was to get it in our heart. And that's the intent today. A temple, if you will, made without hands. Not of stone. But we, being God's people, should have the Torah within our heart. So I ask you to think about that. The testimony should be in our hearts. To the Torah and to the testimony. Until next week, Shalom.
Thank you for listening to Roots of Faith today. For more information, please visit our website at www.rootsoffaith.org. Until next time, Shalom.